your phone. Don't need no speedy car to get me home. Don't need no nothing. All wow. I need is time for the simple life. Ooh, go get your butt off of that lazy couch. Put down a laptop and get out of that house. Don't need no nothing. All I need is time for the simple life.
Thank you, Casey Abrams, the artist and composer of that song, Simple Life. Love that song. Welcome, everybody. It is Saturday, and this is Simple Life, the radio show that focuses on unheard voices of the Central Coast. We have an exception today, however, and that is because there are some times when issues basically outreach their local areas and include the Central Coast, even though they're not focused specifically here, or include people who are limited to being here. And we're very honored and excited to have someone who has left his home in Kentucky, traveled quite extensively to educate people on a very important issue that is affecting all of us who live on planet Earth. Samuel Avery is, he used to teach university level. He also used to have a construction business, and he currently is obviously a published writer, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Keystone XL Tar Sands, and The Battle to Defuse the Carbon Bomb. He also is involved in diffusing the carbon bomb by installing solar for people. So welcome, Samuel. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for bringing me here.
Well, we're delighted to have you, and I know that you have been, you've been on the TV locally. You'll be on KRON tomorrow, you mentioned, and you've been on this program or this station, KRXA, a number of times. And you know, the people in the Central Coast live busy lives, so we really we don't always hear it the first time, and it's always going to be a little bit different aspect of the story as well. Now, this particular topic has been in the news quite a lot lately, and I know there's been a lot of activity on Facebook and Twitter, and I wonder if you could give us a sense, sort of a boiled down picture of what the issue is.
Well, the underlying truth is the reason there is so much publicity about the Keystone XL pipeline is the fact that it's tapping in to the second largest fossil fuel deposit on the planet.
Wow.
And there's so much carbon in the tar sands of Western Canada that it's enough carbon that it could by itself send the Earth's climate into an irreversible tailspin that could get us into some what are called climate feedback loops that could make the climate get hotter and hotter on its own after a threshold period, so that there are lots of sources of fossil fuel, but this one alone is so vast that it's enough to do the job by itself. So if we ever wanted an issue that we could all get together and point to as saying this symbolizes the whole thing, it's not the whole thing, but it's a big enough part of the whole thing that it symbolizes the whole thing. So that those of us who recognize that there's something fundamentally wrong about the direction of human society can look at this Keystone Pipeline and say, that symbolizes the whole thing.
Mm.
We have to stop this from happening.
Right. Now, I appreciated in your book, which, by the way, is for sale at the Pilgrim's Way Community Bookstore in Secret Garden in downtown Carmel, looking at the carbon boycott, chapter 16, you talked about how there is there's a tendency for this to be an overwhelming topic simply because it's everywhere, and you, it's hard for the mind to sort of grapple with it. I mean, we've been using, at least in my lifetime, we've been using fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. I know my mother and grandmother perhaps not, But it's such a commonplace to get in your car or to turn on your stove or, you know, say, yay, we've got clean air on the buses that use natural gas. It's just such an integrated aspect of our civilized life.
Mm-hmm. It's worked its way into nearly everything. You know, if you look back only a few generations, George Washington, he never used any fossil fuel. He was carbon neutral. And yet, since his time, it has become important for heating our homes, for lighting our homes, for transportation, obviously, our cars, our buses, our airplanes. But it's more than that. It's our food. We need fossil fuels to make agricultural fertilizers, to power tractors, to power trucks, to bring food to market, to refrigerate food. Fossil fuel has creeped into every aspect of our lives, and we are just so dependent on it that the transition away from fossil fuel is not, unfortunately, going to be smooth. It's not going to be without disruption. So the first thing that we need to do is to become aware of it. Awareness is always the first point. So this particular issue of the pipeline makes us aware of it. Because if you're against that pipeline, which I am and many people are, that also makes you realize that it's not bad guys against good guys.
Right.
It's not us versus them. It's only us. Because the people who are building the pipeline and the people who are extracting the tar sands out of Canada, they're not doing that for their own pleasure. They're doing that because we're creating the need for it.
Right,
we're
exactly.
Creating the demand. They only sell what we buy from them.
Exactly, exactly.
But at the same time, we have to realize that, you know, much of this is unconscious, though we really don't absolutely depend on fossil fuel, because we could go back to the way George Washington lived and we'd be fine without it. But life doesn't go backwards very well. Civilization doesn't go backwards very well. So we really can't realistically go back to the horse and buggy days. We have to go forward in some sense.
Mm-hmm.
But it's through conscious awareness of how fossil fuels have gotten into such complexities of our life that it's through that kind of awareness that we can begin to untangle our dependence,
mm-hmm.
and look forward to developing a lifestyle which does not require fossil fuel, because we're absolutely going to have to do that. I can't tell you how we're going to do that. I can't tell you it's going to be fun or smooth, but I can tell you that we're going to have to do that somehow or another.
Yeah, there's a portion in what I read recently in your book that put it very pointedly, and it was basically, you know, the carbon bomb will prohibit human life on the planet. And so it behooves us to figure another way to do this, because our expansion at this rate or in this area of civilization is pretty uncivilized when it annihilates us.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we're definitely heading in the direction of self-destruction. And, you know, that sounds scary, and it sounds like alarmist. It is alarmist. I mean, I'm an alarmist. Wake up. You know, it's in a sense, though, I don't mean to just scare people. That's no fun, and it doesn't really motivate people to expand their understanding of something.
Right.
And so what I really aim to do in this book and in this book tour is to promote a wider understanding of human activity, human economic activity, within a larger context, that is, within a context of the Earth as a whole. And what I mean by that is what I call the economic paradigm is the opposite of that. The economic paradigm is all about us humans, what we need. It assumes that economic growth is what human society is all about. And to do that, we promote consumer consumption.
Yeah.
And the economic paradigm assumes that the purpose the role of human society is to meet consumer demand. Whereas the ecologic paradigm, the one that I'm promoting, and the one that is growing and really developing around this issue of the pipeline, is one that accepts the economy. We have to have an economy. We have to have money. We have to have jobs. But it takes the economy and puts it into a much larger context of the ecology, so that we're in there with the oceans and with the forests and with the land and with the climate. We're part of that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Our economic activity is organic in nature. I mean, human civilization works a lot like a living organism in many ways, but it has to be within a larger context in order to survive. It has to be part of the overall living system of the earth.
If you're just joining us, we're here with author Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Keystone XL, Tar Sands, and the Battle to Defuse the Carbon Bomb. He will be speaking later today at the Carmel Art Association beginning 6 o'clock. So what you're saying, Sam, is that basically one of the things that we can do is really raise consciousness, to infuse ideas about where to spend your dollars in a good way. You know, farmers market is an example of that, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. We have enormous power as consumers. I mean, every time you spend a dollar, you're voting. You're voting for a distribution system. You're voting for resource extraction. You're creating these enormous companies that we all like to hate, the big oil companies and the big retailers and so forth and so on. Hey, we're making them. They're responding to us. If it wasn't for us spending dollars the way we do, they wouldn't exist. So we have this enormous power, but we're unconscious of it. We're not aware of it. So that we have to begin to develop awareness around our spending habits. And that's something that the economic paradigm doesn't do. Mm-hmm. There's no consciousness between consumption and extraction. So that part of what I'm trying to do here is to say that we as a civilization have to be able to see where that invisible hand is going and how market forces are leading us to build pipelines like this and to extract these very dangerous resources.
Right. Now, you made a reference comparing this particular issue in this particular time in history to Rosa Parks' experience in 1955. Would you like to share, Sam, some of the thinking that really correlates that in your mind?
Yes. When Rosa Parks sat on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama, and was asked to move to the rear of the bus because she was black, she sat there. She refused to move, thereby breaking the law, and was arrested for that. So that was an act of civil disobedience. Actually, you know, it sounds very spontaneous, but this was planned. This was planned well in advance. And that's very important to realize that, in a way, even if it looks spontaneous, there's a lot of thinking that goes behind something like this.
Right.
Because in civil disobedience, your primary objective is to raise awareness.
Right.
And you're not really telling people what to think. You're not really sculpting an opinion here. You're presenting a truth.
Yes.
And you present that truth through a symbol. A segregated bus is a symbol of a segregated society. So if you can point a finger and say, look, this black woman was tired after work. She was sitting on the bus just like any other person would sit on a bus. And she broke the law by not moving to the back of the bus because of her race. Okay. Now that means all of a sudden people who are witnesses to this event through the media are going to identify with her. See, they're not going to identify with the police.
Yeah, they can relate to the real human aspect.
Right. Say, I felt like I was Rosa Parks there. Therefore, I'm feeling a level of humanity and a level of identity with her, not as a white person.
Sure.
But as a human being.
As a human being.
Right. So that is what led to, I mean, the civil rights movement was a huge paradigm shift in itself because it led to white people identifying with black people's being oppressed. And it didn't make white people feel black. It made white people feel human and right. realize that it was the same thing as the people who are being oppressed. So it brought out, it created a totally different America. We are all different because of that.
We're going to take a short break to honor our sponsors, but please stay with us for more with Sam Avery here on Simple Life. We're back with Simple Life. I'm your host, Cynthia Fernandez, and our guest today is Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Keystone XL, Tar Sands, and the Battle to Defuse the Carbon Bomb. Now, I want to read something that's in your book here, Sam. The real way to stop the pipeline, tar sands extraction, mountaintop removal, fracking, and climate change as a whole, is then simply to stop buying coal, petroleum, and natural gas. The biggest businesses in the world will shrivel up and close their doors in a heartbeat, and the problem will be solved for all time. But boycotts work only if alternatives are developed and become available. Organizing other ways to get places was what made the Montgomery boycott work, and referring to Rosa Parks there. And only organizing other forms of energy will make the carbon boycott work. So what other ways are there to do the things that fossil fuels enable? Things such as fueling your car, heating your home, and growing your food. So you talk about alternatives, and I think that's a really key point here. But it might seem to people that, they're trying to make ends meet as it is economically, and it might seem nearly impossible. What do you say to that, Sam?
Well, it always seems impossible before you do it. And we can become dependent on anything, particularly on consumption. We can get used to whatever we spend money on. After a while, it begins to look like we have to have this in order to live. And because of that, I never, ever tell people what they have to do without, because
it's a personal choice.
You always get in trouble
yeah.
when you do that. But I also know that people, once they're able to overcome some of the dependencies they think they have, are tremendously flexible in developing new ways of getting what they need or just not needing it anymore.
Right.
But they're also, I'll give you an example of a way that we're probably all going to be able to move in the future as far as automobile transportation is concerned. That's a big one.
That is a big one.
And yet, it's really, if we can develop better batteries, we're going to solve that pretty quickly. It's not going to be smooth. In other words, we're not going to just one day have a gasoline car and the next day have an electric car. There's going to be some discontinuity there. But let me give you some basics. As a solar installer, I have come up to realize that a single 250-watt solar panel, that's about 3.5 feet by 5.5 feet, the kind you see installed on rooftops, a single panel can produce 1,500 miles worth of energy to drive an automobile, to drive an electric car, every year.
Wow.
For 30 to 50 years. That's the panels last about that long.
30 to 50 years.
Right.
Yeah.
So one panel, 1,500 miles a year. So if you drive 21,000 miles a year, put 14 panels on your roof.
And you're set.
You're set for life. Now, that's going to cost you $12,000 to $15,000. That's a lot of money. And it's a lot of money to spend up front. And that's the difference. It's an investment. It's not an expense.
Mm.
So you're not spending it every week at the pump. You're putting it down all at once. But once you put it down, the fuel is free. The maintenance is negligible. And when you put that on your roof, you will have the next 600,000 to a million miles of driving.
Wow.
From that solar system. And throughout the life of those panels, you will save about $100,000 in driving expenses, because each mile will cost only about 2.2% at the most. Right now, you're spending 18 to 19 cents per mile.
Per mile, yeah.
For gasoline.
Right.
So if you use a solar-based electric car, you will spend 2 cents more or less per mile. You'll save over $100,000 through the lifetime of those panels, and you won't need a tar sands pipeline. So this sort of thing has yet to be developed.
So it's not in the market yet.
It's not there yet.
But it's coming.
It's coming. We need better batteries in our cars initially.
Yeah, yeah. I can tell you, I feel really good being a Prius owner.
Yes.
And I get bonus points because I'm a Prius owner recycle. So I'm not the first Prius owner.
Okay.
And that person bought another Prius. So the mileage is just stellar compared to, you know, what I used to have. And I've always tried to drive careful. But that is an example of what you're talking about in terms of looking at alternatives that are available and maximizing on those. And for those of you who are just tuning in, we're speaking with Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, speaking about XL Pipeline, tar sands, and the issue that we've all been hearing in the news, and this is Simple Life. So, Sam, you know, the ongoing consumption of fossil fuel is really incompatible with human survival, and you've made a point of that. You've said one way or the other we're at a threshold and things will be different. Now, I know from reading the epilogue in your book that you've seen a lot. You've actually traveled where the pipeline is going. The cover of the book is just striking. It's an actual photograph. Is that in Alberta?
Yes.
And so the destruction of the face of the surface area of the earth is not what any of us, I think, thought. You think of a pipeline, you think of it underground, like maybe wires traveling or something really clean, but you still have your lawn and you have plants and the birds sing. But looking at the photo on the cover of this book, it's just, I don't know, it's heart-stopping.
That's a photograph of a tar sands mine in Alberta. It's the pipeline itself is innocuous.
Unless it breaks, like Arkansas.
Right. Yeah. But it's what comes through the pipeline. It's sort of like a shotgun. A shotgun is just a hollow metal tube, and that's all the pipeline is. But it's what comes through the pipeline. That's what can hurt you. And so this issue is really about the tar sands of Western Canada. And the ecological problems begin where they're mined in Alberta, because they're strip mined, essentially. The surface of the land there is what's called boreal forest.
Old growth forest?
Yeah. It's not as, you know, it's not quite as lush a growth as you would find further south. This is a northern forest, but there's a very thick soil, and there's a lot of, it's a complex ecosystem. But to get to the tar sands, you have to completely obliterate that. You scrape the living surface off the earth in order to get at the tar sand beneath it. It's a lot like mountaintop removal that I'm familiar with in Kentucky. It's an absolute destruction of the living surface of the earth to get at the fuel source underneath.
Yeah.
Not all of the tar sands is mined this way, but a lot of it is. There is another form called in situ mining of the tar sand, which does not destroy the entire surface. It cuts it up with pipelines and access roads, and it makes it unusable for much of the wildlife. But the in situ process, they have to burn a lot of natural gas to heat the tar sand up
to extract it through the
pipeline. So it takes a lot of energy just to get this stuff out of the ground.
That's you know, the other thing, Sam, that I've been noticing whenever I hear reference in the news about the pipeline, certainly when I hear arguments for the pipeline, I don't often hear the detail that this fossil fuel wouldn't even be ready for consumption for 10 years, nor do I hear that it's actually intended to be contracted to countries like China and elsewhere.
Well, the actual fact of the matter is that this tar sand deposit is essentially is landlocked in northwestern Canada. To the west is the Rocky Mountains, to the north is the Arctic Ocean, and to the south and east is the North American continent. So the problem that the people who are trying to develop this huge, huge, multi-trillion barrel deposit of fossil fuel, the big problem is getting it out to a deep water port.
Mm.
And that's what this pipeline is all about. It's being used. Tar sand is already being used, particularly in the upper Midwest of the U.S. and parts of Canada. But it hasn't gotten out to refineries on a coast where it can be sold on the world market.
But so, not necessarily in the U.S.
Well, it could be sold in the U.S. The point is it's on the world market. We'll still have access to it, but the world market prices are considerably higher than domestic U.S. prices.
Understood.
So that's the reason they want to get it out to a deep water port.
Right.
And that'll make it possible for tar sands to be burned all over the planet.
Mm.
And see, that's why this pipeline is so important to the developers of tar sand and so important to the people who want to stop the development of tar sands.
Mm-hmm.
That's why this is such a big issue.
We're speaking to Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm. His book was just released about a week ago, and he will be speaking at the Carmel Art Association this evening at 6 o'clock. Contact Pilgrim's Way to RSVP and find out more details. And that number is 831-624-4955. So this pipeline, Sam, goes through a number of states in the U.S. It originates in Canada, of course, and then I've seen posts of how it comes right through Indian reservations in the Dakotas. It continues through Nebraska, Oklahoma, and then the harvesting point is in Texas.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And, well, and you've actually, you know, talked with the people who are experiencing this in their backyard.
That's right. Yeah, I spoke to people all along the route of the pipeline. Beginning in Canada. But I should point out that it's a little bit confusing here, that it's the southern portion of the pipeline that goes from Oklahoma down through Texas. That's being built right now.
So it's already in process.
Right. That did not require State Department approval because it does not cross an international boundary.
And there are other pipelines in existence, so why did this one require a bill?
Well, it's not so much a bill, it's just the fact that the Keystone XL pipeline originates in Canada and crosses an international boundary into the U.S. That means that it required State Department approval.
Oh.
The State Department, of course, takes care of foreign affairs. So that's why an environmental statement ended up in the State Department, which is kind of a misplacement. But that's why it's in the White House. See, the president has to approve it if it crosses a state line.
And he's delayed it a number of times, is that right?
He has, yes.
Any news on that?
No. We don't know what he's going to do.
No.
I'm pretty well convinced he's going to approve it. I'm not absolutely sure of that, but I'm not depending on his disapproval to stop this pipeline.
Got it.
And if he stops it, it will be because people have resisted it. There have been over 1 million letters written into the State Department in opposition to the pipeline. So that's very encouraging.
And a number of protests, too, around the White House. I know Bill McKibben, who wrote the foreword on your book here, was part of the 350.org organization of protests at the White House. And a local friend of mine who was able to attend one of those actually came back and shared with me that it was an amazing experience because, first of all, there's just masses and masses of people out in the street and everywhere, and their temperament was good. There was no, you know, there was no anger, there was no violence, no hostility even. And the other aspect that she shared that really impressed me, I hadn't imagined it before she described it, was that there were all age groups, there were all walks of life, all economic levels, I guess you could say. And she said, you know, there were Republicans next to liberals, next to Democrats. It just, this is a human issue. It's not a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your experience?
Yeah. Because I was there too. I was part of that demonstration, and that would have been August of 2011. And I was arrested there. I was part of the 1,250 some people, and that really gave the White House a reason to oppose the pipeline. It would have just sailed through if
otherwise,
it hadn't been for
yeah.
that, right? So it's the reason it's been delayed as long as it has been. Now we don't know if he will continue to oppose it, but I'm not dependent on that, because I think this issue is a much bigger than Barack Obama. It involves everybody, like you say, because the climate issue, as soon as we're talking about climate, we're talking about everybody's backyard. We're talking about everybody's relation to the natural world. And so that's why it's important to have such diversity of people. And because there were a lot of American Indians there, a lot of African Americans, all kinds of individuals. It wasn't just some sort of a elite environmentalist type.
Well, and I think, Sam, something like this, although I realize it's connected to the climate change, it's also connected to poisoning the earth.
Mm-hmm.
It's all over the place if you actually look for it, how animals are dying, or their health, their bodies are changing, the trees are dying. I mean, it's not just the climate, like, you know, tornadoes or floods. It's really our food system and our water system.
Absolutely.
Is being affected.
The water is a big issue everywhere. One of the first places I saw how important that was in Alberta itself.
Mm.
The Athabasca River Valley is where this major tar sands deposits are. And there are a lot of First Nation people up there, Cree and Dene peoples, whose land is being taken away from them. And it's their land that's being destroyed by these tar sands mines. And it's... To me, it was very interesting talking to them. I interviewed four of them for this book, in that these are people who are highly educated.
Mm.
I mean, they carry cell phones. They're very well connected.
Sure.
They know what the bigger world is about. But a lot of them still are contacted with their local villages. And many of them were raised in local villages. And they assume that the earth is alive.
They assume that.
I mean, mm-hmm. they know that. They know that on a level that I've not seen before on other people. You know, and we talk about that, and we can intellectually assume that in a way.
Yeah.
But for us, it's like a Gaia hypothesis, or it's something that we have to put together before we realize it.
It's a logical deduction.
Right.
But for them, they have a relationship.
It's something that they know.
Yeah.
On a very fundamental level. So to see these huge companies and these huge bulldozers and enormous trucks come in and just rip the life out of the land,
right?
It's something which they cannot understand. They simply cannot. They have no way of putting that into their worldview.
Yeah, it's as if the bulldozers and what's behind them just don't recognize the life that's present. For them.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, like your little kid is out in the street and the car doesn't even recognize that mm-hmm. it's there and you're trying to save its life.
Right.
Stay with us. We're going to take another short break. We'll be back with Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm. And we're back with Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Keystone XL, Tar Sands, and the Battle to Defuse the Carbon Bomb. Sam will be speaking tonight at the Carmel Art Association across from Pilgrim's Way Bookstore in downtown Carmel on 5th between, we're not on 5th, we're on Dolores between 5th and 6th. So, Sam, you wanted to give us an update about a commitment that some individuals felt really strongly about. Can you share that?
Yes, we were talking earlier about the role of civil disobedience. And I should say that you don't start out with civil disobedience. This is something that you use as a last resort, and you develop a strategy in which civil disobedience becomes a part, and you have to do it in a way that it will be effective. But just in the last couple of months, a petition has gone out online through Credo Action that asks for people to sign a pledge to resist the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline through civil disobedience if necessary. And 59,000 people have already signed up for that. That's quite a number of people. I'm one of them. Many of us will be going to the route of the pipeline. Of course, I've already been there, and I have a lot of friends there and know what's happening. And but other people are going to be showing up along there. And we very simply are going to stand between the earth and the destruction of the earth. We're going to pledge, though, to be peaceful, to be civil, to be polite. Those things are very important. The police are not our enemy. Even though we may have to break the law, we may have to do some occupying, which will be illegal, and we may have to get arrested. We're not going there for the purpose of being arrested, but we may be arrested in the process. But the police are not our enemies here. Actually, we don't have any enemies. And that's what makes this growing movement unique, in that there are people who are standing in our way and are opposing what we're trying to do, obviously. But they're not bad guys. We're all in the same boat together.
And Sam, you have personal experience at this being arrested stuff.
Yes, well, I was arrested in East Texas also, essentially for standing alongside the road.
Yeah, I read the story in the back of your book. That was pretty fascinating.
Yeah.
I have a lot of respect for your restraint.
Mm-hmm.
And your courage to just go with it.
Well, that makes it a lot easier, actually. Because as soon as you start pointing the finger and saying this person is bad or evil, you're going to get a reaction. They're going to have to defend themselves. And then that's going to come back to you in some way or another. And if we don't have to find an enemy in order to raise the kind of awareness we want to raise.
So what do you suggest for our listeners who are really feeling like we are, that they really want to take care of the earth? They'd like to find another way to do what they need to do to live in our lifestyle currently. What would you suggest?
Well, the number one thing that everybody who's concerned about this should do is to simply learn more about the issue, to be aware of the changes that are happening, to encourage them in any way you can. In your personal life, with your friends and so forth, and try to do it without gaining opposition, without getting a reaction that simply by offending other people. You want to try to avoid that. And changes in lifestyle, be aware of the fossil fuels that you're using. You're not going to be able to get off of fossil fuel completely, but being aware of how you are dependent on it, and kind of in your long-term decisions, be thinking about if you buy a new house, how are you going to come and go from that house? What kind of means of transportation are you going to need? What kind of stores are nearby to that house? And also in the jobs that you take, the long-term things that you do, these are where your most important decisions happen. Also, just in the small things, you know, do you recycle? I mean, that's important too. It's a matter not so much of finding the way to live and starting living that way tomorrow. It's a gradual process. But the most important thing is awareness.
I appreciate that. We're speaking with Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, and talking about his book, which is for sale at the Pilgrim's Way Community Bookstore. I have a quote here for you, Sam. Howard Zinn said, "We don't have to engage in grand, heroic actions to participate in the process of change. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world." And I think he was right about that.
Absolutely.
So, wanted to share one passage that you had here that really impressed me. It really touched me. And that is about the boycotting. It says, "So let us boycott carbon, but please don't be a Puritan about it. Don't sweat the small stuff. Don't do everything perfectly. Don't drive your friends crazy and make them defensive. How your life reflects into the community is more important than any particular action you take. Lighten up. Drive down to McDonald's every once in a while and buy a hamburger."
I got in trouble for that sentence, believe me.
I bet you did. "The evolution can wait. Have fun. Enjoy." And it's really such a powerful point that you make. The things that we feel strongly about, sometimes we do take too seriously. We take it out of perspective. And I don't know, the story of the tortoise and the hare comes to mind. You know, slow but steady wins the race. Mm-hmm. Whereas if we distract ourselves with hostility and rage and, you know, like you said, being puritanical about it, it can really distract us from the ultimate goal, because we are all in this together and we want to make sure that we don't alienate everybody else in the process.
Yeah, and if we point the finger and find all the mean people, the bad people, then that means we have to be good and perfect in our own behavior, and that's pretty hard to do.
So right.
You don't want to try to be perfect. It's no fun.
No, it's no fun, and it's really not the end game. You know, life is to be enjoyed, and so in the process of being struck by the soberness of this situation in progress and what might happen, we got to remember to smell the roses along the way. You know, have lunch with a friend, maybe walk instead of drive, carpool, consolidate your errands. You know, feel good about it rather than hateful at the oil companies who are taking advantage of us at the pump. And like you said, finding other ways of doing things is really very freeing. Next week I didn't mention this to you, but I'm going to be attending the Buckeye Gathering, which is held up north in California at Forestville. It's some property that's actually owned and managed by a Native community. And the Buckeye Gathering is really motivated by the intention of sharing, teaching, and learning Indigenous ways. And so someone asked me the other day when I told them I was going to this, why would you want to do that? You know, you've got a perfectly good house. You've got a perfectly good car. I'm sure you sleep in a bed. And I tried to explain that when I go camping or when I participate in naturalist programs, we have a tracking club that meets once a month, the first Sunday at 8 a.m. out in Fort Ord, there's this incredible freeing feeling that accompanies it. When you don't have to do it a particular way, when you have choices and you can find a way that feels more aligned with life on the planet, you can find a way that's more peaceful. And really, the ultimate, I guess, is it's very empowering.
You know how I do that? I live on a farm in Kentucky, a small homestead. It's not really a commercial farm by any means. And I grow a lot of my food, not all of it, but I grow a lot of it. And I grow a lot of black-eyed peas and dried beans and things like that. It's not very glamorous food, but I do eat it quite a bit. And I grow enough of it that if I really had to, I could survive on that stuff. I don't have to.
Thankfully.
But but it's a choice. Like you said, it's a choice. And so that to me is like everything else I do. If I go out to a restaurant or go to go buy a glass of wine or a mug of beer, that's on top of mere survival for me. It's not a dependency. I'm not dependent on the commercial economy, ultimately, even though I like it.
yeah. You don't require it to be okay, and you don't require it to be happy.
That's right.
Yeah, I think we're lulled into thinking that Our comforts in life actually are what make us happy. And it's always amazing to see or hear or know someone who doesn't have those comforts in life and they are happy. Mm-hmm. That the two are not inseparable, actually.
If they're a dependency, they're no longer a comfort. So if you can get to a point where your dependency is somewhere else, then things that used to be a dependency all of a sudden become luxuries, and you can appreciate them, and you can enjoy life more. So a lot of what we're talking about here in resisting this pipeline, in resisting the enormous ecological damage to the planet as a whole, that this pipeline and this tar sands deposit is going to do, if we're not aware of it, if we don't think about the mess we're going to get ourselves in, a lot of the answer to that is just to live more simply, to appreciate things, appreciate family and community and getting together with other people and not having to spend lots of money and have lots of stuff.
Right. You don't have to really feel that pressure from keeping up with the Joneses or doing what your friends and family expect you to do to be a success. Actually, success is an internal job, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Doing what you feel strongly about and following your passion. And I can see that in you, Sam. You are following your passion. So you, as a historian, you really, I think, were in a position to appreciate the way things used to be and how people used to live. And, you know, putting yourself more or less in harm's way to protect that is really admirable. I have great respect for you.
And it's just, to me, it's the most natural thing in the world. It's not, I don't feel like it's heroic by any means. It's just doing what seems right to do.
Well, there you have it. Sam Avery, author of The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Keystone XL, Tar Sands, and the Battle to Defuse the Carbon Bomb. He will be speaking tonight at the Art Association in Carmel, and he will be signing books later at the bookstore. And so give a call or just show up. There should be enough room. It's a very large space. We hope to see you there, and we will be back with you next Saturday on Simple Life. Zabadab, 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 zabad